afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And so between the three of us, well, Bob doesn't race in here. He doesn't race in here on our time. He races in earlier. What time do you race in here, Bob?
Oh, on Sundays, like a quarter to seven.
Oh.
Oh. I didn't know there was a quarter to seven.
Yeah, there's no quarter to seven on my Sunday. But Phil and I usually race in here and meet Bob, who's all organized, got his stuff all situated, and we fly into our chairs.
I've had a five-hour head start on you.
Yeah, you should be pretty well situated by then. Oh, my gosh. Well, we had so much fun last week with William Kay. We thought we would continue on since there were lots of things we didn't actually discuss. And I do want to let you know that there is a really good video that he did. It's 10 minutes. I watched it while I was scurrying on the treadmill. Probably the last scurry that treadmill's going to do.
You broke it.
What's going on? It's at Malfunction Junction. Well, it was going at 20 miles an hour, and I can't really walk that fast. I'm not sure why you have a treadmill that goes 20 miles an hour.
It just needs a little WD-40.
It's like a car.
It fixes everything.
No, it said it was going there. It's kind of like, okay, I can't do that. I could do like 3 miles an hour, walk along, watch a video. I could do that.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just wanted to let you know at wethepeopleradio.us, we've got a great video there that William did about one of the topics we're going to be discussing today. And then we have a good cartoon about the Canadians. Just in case you're not online, and just in case William hasn't seen it yet, it's Barack Obama and Joe Biden sitting in the back of the beast, probably. And Obama says, they're not buying the Russian crap. And then Biden says, let's blame it on the Canadians. I saw that today. I thought it would be appropriate. So the Canadians get a plug, you know.
It's about time we blame
it on the Canadians. So William will be here to represent them. I guess he's up.
Team Canada.
Yeah. Go Canada.
Hey.
I saw that. I was like, well, that's kind of funny. First thing in my inbox for today. Blame it on the Canadians. Oh, my gosh. So, Mr. K, got your latest video up on there.
Yeah, this is something new for me. That's the first time I've actually made a video by myself. I've been doing this sort of just writing for the Internet, and I've decided that I better branch out and get with the program here, get with the 21st century, and start making my own videos. So that was my first attempt at a solo video. The other videos, I actually hired a company to do them, but this is the first time I
bought
my
scenery.
Own camcorder.
You had scenery in the other ones. This one didn't have this one. This one kind of had that insane asylum backdrop.
I'll wear a straitjacket for the next one.
I'm going to tune in. I mean. but I did kind of chuckle. I was like, what happened to the lovely scenery? He's got the insane asylum going on there. Oh, my gosh.
I just saw the blank wall. Maybe I'll do it against the window next time.
The green screen wasn't working.
I'll mix that up.
As long as nobody... I don't know what your neighbors are doing, but, the window could be dicey. You never can tell. Oh, my gosh. So, I don't know where you want to start today.
Well, I really enjoyed that video. I mean, you know, last week we talked about the whole European connection to global warming and the you know, eco-fascism, but the German connection was kind of interesting. I think we ought to maybe start there.
Yeah, since your website is ecofascism.com, I mean, let's go right to the big players in fascism.
Okay.
Or the big player.
Well, always... You know, fascism is a tricky thing. It's certainly getting bounced around a lot these days. When you mention the word big players, what comes to mind, what I was doing in terms of researching for this show is going back and reminding myself who some of the really big players are in the climate campaign, which, of course, is just one part of the environmental movement. And there's a misperception out there that the environmental movement is run by groups like Greenpeace and the Sierra Club and Friends of the Earth, et cetera. And those are big, influential organizations. I'm not denying that. But the overall movement is much, much larger than that. And those groups, they perform a function within the movement of giving it a sense that it's sort of a mass movement, that it's sort of the people rising up. They perform that function within the movement. But there are other organizations that you don't hear much about. One of the things on my website, I got a list of all the various enviro-skeptical groups in the world that I've come across. And I, reading through those websites, you know, very few organizations really understand, even the skeptics and the enviro-critics really understand the organizations that are behind things like the climate change campaign. I was hoping I could just sort of mention a few of those and profile a few of the organizations that are behind it. Okay, well, there's one group, and it's called KFW. And you'd be forgiven for not knowing what that meant. It's a German word, and it means the Bank of Reconstruction. And it was actually set up by the Americans after World War II to help, you know, most of a lot of German houses were destroyed, their factories were destroyed, and this is part of the Marshall Plan to help Germany rebuild, Western Germany rebuild. The Americans set up a bank called the Bank for Reconstruction. And for the first several years of its existence, it was more or less lending out money that was given to it by the American government through the Marshall Plan. But after several years of making those loans, it could sort of stand on its own. It was raising its own revenues. It was getting money back from the loans that it already made. And it morphs into a rather large financial institution. It's still government-owned. They don't have states or provinces in Germany. They've got these lands. And those various provinces of Germany collectively own KFW. And it's a major bank in Germany, but it remains government-owned. And I'll just read a little quote from their existing, their current website right now, that KFW is supporting the energy turnaround, this transition to the renewable energy in Germany. Over the next 5 years, they will be spending 100 billion euros, which is, I don't know what now, like 120, 130 billion U.S. That's their investment into all sorts of renewable energy and green technologies and clean, climate-friendly technologies. So that's one company that's probably right now lending out at sort of zero-interest loans or no-interest loans about $25 billion U.S. a year.
Wow.
That's their commitment to it. And, of course, it's a government-owned entity, but it's deeply invested in this climate transformation or the energy transformation that is going on in Germany. That's one organization. There's another one called Springer Nature, and it is a subsidiary of a German firm called Holzbrink, which is, last week I mentioned there was a company called Bertelsmann that's putting out about half the books in English in the world right now are being published by one German multinational. Springer Nature is a subsidiary of another major German publishing multinational, and this one owns... it's the world's largest publisher of scientific literature and academic literature. It owns Scientific American. It owns Nature magazine. They boast about being the authoritative voice of science and climate around the world. There's about three major European multinationals that are involved in book publishing, and I'm guessing that right now in the United States, over two-thirds of all the books that are being purchased are coming out of these three companies. They have a real lock on that aspect of American culture. And each one of them can be profoundly linked to the climate movement. This Springer Nature, they accumulate all these scientific journals as part of this buying spree they went through. A lot of the money that they got for that came from a fund called the Climate Capital Change Fund. And it's, again, dominated by these wealthy European aristocratic types. And to pull together this sort of pool of scientific journals that they could use to dominate that sector of the industry. But these aren't small outfits. These are Springer, Holzbrink group itself, a multi-billion dollar a year affair. And it's really targeting scientific literature, particularly climate literature. And Scientific American magazine has been, notoriously global warming alarmist from its inception. So, there's quite a host of these sorts of business enterprises out there that, of course, are much larger and much more influential than the sort of environmental activist groups that we think about. I could run through sort of many of these sorts of organizations And when you do that, you start realizing how deeply involved the European economy is with this whole climate change campaign.
You know, we have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, you should, it would be great if you kind of lined out the European connection again for maybe people who didn't hear last week.
Okay.
Because that was really interesting. It was just a way of looking at it that we completely had.
Well, I hadn't heard that before either.
Yeah, just
it
hadn't
made total sense.
Thought about it, but it made a lot of sense.
Okay, yeah, good idea, because those tuning in for the first time are sort of coming in halfway through the show. They wouldn't, I'll back it up and take another run at that.
Okay.
All right, we'll be back.
Okay.
You are listening to We the People Radio. You can join us at wethepeopleradio.us for all the information about our guests, links to websites, and all previous shows for a bunch of years. We are sponsored this hour by Powerhouse Solar. It was founded in 2003 by Bruce and Susan Blake, grown into the North State's premier solar company. Welcome back. You're listening to We the People Radio. We're here with William Kay, and we are discussing the politics of climate change. You know, we could fight about the science all day long, but the politics are a lot more interesting. All right. Hit it, William, with the backstory.
Okay. I think we have to bring our listeners up to speed. Some of them might not have been tuned in last week. To understand the whole global warming campaign, one has to go back to the 1970s during the OPEC crisis and have to keep in mind that the countries of Western Europe, Germany, France, Denmark, Italy, etc., they have no oil, they have no natural gas. Germany's got a little bit of coal, but it's not very competitive. Basically, these are countries, this is an area of the world that is denuded of sort of natural fossil fuel endowment. So as oil became more expensive due to OPEC, those countries in the 1970s collectively resolved that they were going to transition away from the fossil fuel economy and towards the renewable energy, clean, green economy. Now, this program started for several years before they rebranded it as the climate change campaign. They were already well underway to transitioning to the renewable energy economy when they got the brainwave to turn it into a global endeavor. The thinking in Germany and these other countries is that it's not just enough for Europe to transition away from the fossil fuel economy. If they can get the world to transition away from that, and if they are the early adapters and have the technologies manufactured locally to do things like biofuels, wind turbines, what have you, then it'll be a win-win situation. They will no longer have to import all these fossil fuels, and on the other hand, they'll get to export a lot of renewable energy technology. So this was a strategy that was developed in Europe starting in the 1970s, converted to the climate change campaign in the 1980s, and they proceed with that.
So it was all based basically on the fact that they didn't have the natural resources, and so by switching everybody else over to renewables, they would be on an even playing field with the rest of the world.
That's largely it. Like right now, the EU is importing around $500 billion a year in fossil fuels from Russia, OPEC, what have you. So it's a huge drain. Plus, as you mentioned, there's this other factor of their industries are not competitive because energy costs so much more in Europe than other places. They are at a real disadvantage compared to the United States. If it gets really competitive, You know, the countries that have the cheapest energy are the ones that are going to thrive and succeed. There's other factors involved there. But the real master plan was to convert the whole world to renewable energy and have them buy wind turbines and biofuel digesters and hybrid motor vehicles from Europe, because Europe was going to be the place that it was going to make the transition first, and their companies would be in on the ground floor of this. That's why I was bringing up things like KfW, that German bank. The first 15,000 wind turbines in Germany that were built for commercial purposes were all financed by basically zero interest loans from that one bank.
Yeah.
And that's the German government driving that. A lot of European countries have that base built into their economy. And that's when we, you know, I really enjoyed reading how they, Donald Trump's new climate page or new energy first page on his website that they put up during his inaugural event. The White House changed the website from Obama's energy plan to Trump's. But if you look at it, you know, it's all about, American energy independence. Well, that's what Europe wants. The big difference is that America has enormous amounts of fossil fuels.
Correct.
So American energy independence means really developing their own natural gas deposits, developing shale oil, you know, unleashing the coal mining industry again. That's not an option available to Europe.
So they're just making Europe's problem America's problem.
Bingo.
Yes.
Bingo.
Yep.
And, you know, the way they do that is, you know, well, another thing that happened that unbeknownst to the citizens of Gotham was in the 1980s, when this campaign started, there was a concerted effort on the part of several European multinationals to accumulate cultural assets in America surreptitiously. That is when Bertelsmann went in and started buying up American book publishing companies. They now own 250 of them. Holtsprink was doing the same thing. A group from France was doing the same thing. There's another business in France called Vivendi. They're producing now 50% of all new music sales in the United States are owned by this Vivendi. And these companies all do the same thing. There's an illusion of hundreds of independent book publishers and hundreds of independent music producers. But, you know, go to their websites and they just give you this long list of all the, independent record producers and book publishers that they own. So part of this campaign, like owning things like Scientific American Magazine and Nature American Magazine and, you know, all these academic journals that they have accumulated, have had a profound influence on public perceptions of how serious this climate problem is. But the two things had to happen in conjunction. You know, the movement to, it's an economic warfare campaign against American energy infrastructure. Left to the market devices, America would never have left coal. 70% of American electricity would probably be coming from coal. But the war on coal, had a devastating effect on the American economy. Simply would not have happened without this whole climate change campaign. So it was, you know, a big part of this campaign was this move to acquire key aspects of American culture, particularly book publishing, etc. They have quite a stake in this. Like a book publishing and academic journal publishing in America is dominated by several companies from Europe, headquartered in Europe.
Well, their other big push is to get rid of hydroelectric. I mean, absolutely the cheapest, cleanest form of power. And the environmental, you know, I'm use that term really broadly, but the environmental focus is to get rid of all hydroelectric dams in general.
Yes.
Ostensibly for the fish, of course.
They like sort of these micro hydro ones that are rather useless. Once again, Europe has got a problem that North America doesn't have. It isn't as though you could put a massive dam on the Rhine or a lot of the major European rivers without flooding entire cities. They don't have the vast open spaces that North America does. We could, if we wanted to, build large dams. They're planning one in northern British Columbia. It's not going to dislocate a single person. So in a densely populated place like Western Europe, once again, they're at a disadvantage. They could put in these little micro hydro dams here and there, but the idea of blocking a whole river and creating a huge reservoir of water is not an option available to them. Well, yeah, there's a whole other aspect to this. I mean, the campaign against hydro dams in the United States, it predates the climate change campaign by a long shot. One of the earliest American environmental movement campaigns was against the Hetch Hetchy Dam in California. So they've been attacking hydroelectricity for a long time. Like in Europe, it goes back almost a century. These are people who do not believe in unrestricted economic growth. They want very much controlled growth. They're not so interested in the broader masses having consumer items or electricity and these sorts of things. They're quite hostile to that. They want very restricted, slow growth, etc. So you have to separate out some of the environmental campaigns from some of the other ones. A lot of the hydro dam people around the world, the ones who are promoting it, keep saying, well, this is climate friendly. There's no CO2 here. But this is something, there hasn't been, I think, a really major hydroelectric dam built in the United States now for 40 years.
Well, knowing the European situation, as far as energy and Trump's energy policy, what do you think that's going to do to European relations if we start moving towards energy independence and moving away from their grand plan? Do you think it's even possible?
They are going to resist it. It's going to be extremely unpopular in Europe. They have bet the farm on the world going climate-friendly green. So this is going to really strain and sabotage American-European relations, probably irreparably. People underestimate how deeply invested the Europeans are in this transition to the renewable energy economy. There's an interesting website. It's called the Asset Owner Disclosure Project, and they rate 500 global financial enterprises on how climate serious they are and how much of their clients' money they have sunk into renewable energy of all different types. And, number four on that list is the Dutch or the Netherlands public pension fund. One in six people in the Netherlands have their pensions locked into this giant state fund, over $400 billion in assets. And it is number four on the list of climate-serious financial organizations. And it has already invested scores of billions of dollars in green companies and companies that are involved in the climate industrial complex. Every teacher in Holland, that's their pension fund. Every professor in Holland, that's their pension fund. So it isn't as though that Europe can say, oh, well, to hell with this whole climate thing. Let's go back and just, buying fossil fuels from around the world. Let's give up on this. They are so committed to this. They are so institutionally committed to this.
And what was that thing called again?
They're going to have a very difficult time.
Well, what was that called again? The Asset Owner what?
The Asset Owner Disclosure Project. And it lists all the – I'll tell you who figures very high on the list, that CalPERS, the California Public
I was just going to say California.
Big surprise. Uh-huh. Another good
decision. They're number nine on the list.
Sure.
So they have also sunk a huge amount of their, their people's money in the California Public Employees Retirement System.
So
they are number nine on the list of the most, sort of climate serious financial companies in the world. It's companies like that that are going to take a massive hit. Like if Trump succeeds, that's going to mean an end to all these subsidies to ethanol and wind power and all this sort of stuff. A lot of those companies are hanging on to assets. They're going to be pretty much worthless.
We need to take a break, we come back, let's stay on this topic because I'm kind of curious what Europe's situation is if they have to go this road on their own. Can they sustain
can they do it?
So we'll hit that when we come back.
Cool. All right. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We only take the breaks so we can see what music Bob has for us. Otherwise, there's no incentive. Thanks, Bob. All right, William, what do you think? Can the Europeans handle renewable energy? Can they be in their own little renewable energy bubble?
Alone? Well, the fancy word is autarky, which means sort of an economic strategy where you import and export nothing. You are entirely self-sufficient. There is probably a faction of the European environmental movement, like the green parties themselves, that would be okay with that. It would be an economic disaster, but they could probably survive. They go ahead with this transformation. The goal is by 2040, they have eliminated, this is the current goal, they eliminate the internal combustion engine by 2040. Every vehicle in Europe is electric, and this is almost entirely driven from wind power, solar power, biofuel, methane digesters, waste products, what have you. That sort of system is going to give you very expensive electricity. The products that they would be manufacturing, like the electric vehicles, what have you, right now they're not popular around the world. They're just too expensive. They just don't have the mileage and what have you. That they can't go the distances. These are, so they'd be manufacturing a lot of products that nobody wanted to buy. Their overall manufacturing cost would be a lot higher than their competitors. But they could probably survive. They would slowly and surely become like second world status countries. The rest of the world would leave them behind. But there is certainly a faction within the European environmental movement that they're okay with that. These are neo-feudalists, they were fundamentally hostile to the Industrial Revolution from the beginning. If they went back to a society that was, predominantly rural, and poor, and tourism and things like that were the main sectors of the economy, they could live with that. There's a certain portion of them that could probably, welcome a certain degree of deindustrialization.
Well, so they're certainly okay with the United States going that route right now. I mean, they just assume we fall back in line and let everybody else play catch up while we sit on our hands and pay more for everything. It just seems like that's what they're all right with now.
Oh, yeah. Ideally, they'd want sort of the whole world to make this transition. But if the United States, if Trump is a permanent phenomenon and a permanent redirection of the American economy, Europe would be really left behind. It would become a real sort of industrial backwater, like a second world country. It would end up, sort of in that sort of situation. So they could probably do it. They probably wouldn't starve to death, but they would be in a period of sort of relative decline with the rest of the world. There's a certain aspect of their public that could probably okay with that. That is not the plan. The plan is to, pressure the entire world to go along with this agenda, and the whole world is supposed to transition away from fossil fuels. If you believe their climate rhetoric, that we're catastrophically destroying the Earth's atmosphere, which is, of course, this big lie that they've ginned up to rationalize their own self-serving energy policies.
Well, don't you think Don't you think we've kind of been in a little bit of a state of decline trying to follow the whole green energy idea in the last, 8 years? I mean, I think that's been a big gripe with people is going down this road is just costing so much money and we're getting very little
in return. The Solyndra things and all that kind of stuff that have just been hugely
there's
expensive.
Been one boondoggle after that's all money that because keep taking the money they've poured into wind turbines and ethanol things like that. If that went into building coal-fired power plants, you'd have free electricity in America.
Well, if it, half of it went into just rebuilding our infrastructure, we'd have jobs. I mean, they've wasted so much.
It's a sinkhole. I mean, you're suppressing one of your primary assets in America is the fact that America is this, you know, natural energy superpower.
No, we're a resource giant.
Coal,
yeah,
oil, uranium, it's got it all. There's absolutely no reason why America would go along with this program unless they were being manipulated by foreign powers. They do. They're strong allies within America. They have the coastal elites, you know, San Diego to Sacramento and you know, Boston down to Baltimore. The sort of the elites from those small slivers of America are very much on board with this agenda. But in general, this is not a made-in-America energy policy at all.
No, and it doesn't
fit.
You
don't need this. It's holding you back big time.
Yeah, it just doesn't fit over here. We I think as Americans have a real problem turning our back on all our vast natural resources so that we can pursue an energy plan that just costs nothing but money and truly isn't proven yet.
Well, you have all sorts of things. You know, you look into the you look out a little farther into what's surrounding all of it. You know, what other things are happening at the same time. And you look at things like our forest policy. You know, how do we treat our vast amount of forests on the West Coast? Now, we used to harvest timber and, you know, keep the forest from, you know, burning up every year.
Replanting. I mean, it was a crop and we took good care of it.
Sure. And the Forest Service funded itself that way. That mm-hmm. was part of how they got their money to maintain the national forest. That was part of taking care of the people's land. And now it's, you know, it's just one lawsuit after the next by the environmental groups. But I'll tell you what, removing the Equal Access to Justice Act would put the skids on that in, I mean,
oh, yeah.
5 seconds.
Now they're gonna have to pay for their own lawsuits. The government isn't gonna.
They don't
get paid to sue. Yeah, give them money to sue us.
Right. So then we'd get some honest lawsuit. You know, I mean, I'm air quoting that. Some honest lawsuits, not just the kind, you know, not just the kind that where they sue so they can make money, because they do. They'll file just the most ludicrous things, but they get paid for it, so they do it.
Yeah, there's I've written quite a few articles about that. It's been quite a cash cow for the green groups. Yeah, and there's, I forget the name they use for it, these sort of really phony lawsuits where a federal government agency will basically solicit some green group to sue them. And then they settle out of court, and that court order becomes an excuse to expand the permit of that federal agency. There's been scores of those. And because you're settling out of court, you can sort of add whatever conditions you want to that agreement. And usually they add conditions to the effect that the plaintiff's legal costs will be covered. So
they're always covered. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it never costs them any money to do that. That's always part of the settlement. So we end up paying for it on both sides every time.
Oh, everything you can say about America, it goes, you know, tenfold for Canada, because we've got nothing but natural resources up here.
Oh, sure.
But it's a similar sort of strategy. And if you look back to sort of the European, North American competition, if you go, let's go way back. Let's go back to after the Civil War. You know, America built 3 transcontinental railways and Canada built 1. And those railways were financed with land grants. The deal was they sort of created a checkerboard pattern on either side of the railway, usually, you know, 10, 20 miles, and every dark-colored square would be given to the railway company if they built the railway, and the other squares would remain public property. But it was these huge land grants to the railway companies, which were a great idea. That was how that's how the West was won, and it's how those railways were built. The railways, and then the government, went to Europe, because now we had the railways, we needed to get farmers and people out here, and they solicited to people in Europe. This was from the sort of 1860 to 1880s era. And several hundred thousand European farmers came over.
Yeah, settle the West.
Yes, and this, you know, it was designed by Abraham Lincoln. You got 160 acres free land, no money down. It was a win-win situation. You had these sort of desperately poor farmers across Western Europe. But then, of course, the aristocrats of Europe, they didn't like this. But to them, this was the apocalypse. They were the whole towns in Italy and Germany just completely depopulated. I mean, the offer of free land, they were out of there. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the princes and what have you were thinking, well, where's the love, guys? I mean, you know, you've been our sort of serfs for all these centuries, and now you get an opportunity for free land, and you all take off, which they did.
And you all take
but
off.
But keep in mind, west of Chicago, half the land is still owned by the federal government. I mean, this process of really throwing the land open, more or less freely, came to a screeching halt with Teddy Roosevelt.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts setting aside all this and blocking this, and there's a whole bunch of complete phoniness in his propaganda. But so before that, with the Puritans, you know, you got off the boat, they were doing the same thing, 160 acres free land, they give you a Bible, a farm, and, you know, have at it. And there was a long period in American history and in Canadian history, if you could go out in the bush and create a farm, you were doing God's work. You're doing a good thing. And they would facilitate that. And if you could turn a patch of bush into a farm, you owned it. They would give you the title to it. You earned it. That's how America was founded, on those principles, that the public domain. If you could go out there and start a mine or, you know, get a logging camp going, you could keep the money. And then as urbanization developed around New York, on the website, I give the history of some of the major American parks. The most important one is the Adirondack Park in New York State. That was the first one. At this time, sort of New York, New Jersey were sort of built up urban areas. This is in the 1870s, 1880s. Land was getting very expensive there, and there was a land rush moving into upstate New York. And of course, the wealthy burghers of New York and what have you, including the Roosevelt family, who've been in this business for a very long time, they wanted to put a stop on that. So they declared the Adirondacks into this park. They had to remove about 10,000 people from the park. In 1905, William Rockefeller bought a whole town in the Adirondacks, burned every house down, and planted trees all over where those houses were, and he was given a full-page blow-up on the cover of the Collier's magazine of William Rockefeller, defender of the wilderness. But the idea that if you just let people move into the wilderness like that, you're really going to depress land prices in the urban areas. And it's a process whereby the Europeans and the coastal elites, again, started to keep the land off limit to the people. They wanted to, what had been part of the American tradition for a long time had to be brought to an end. Otherwise, people were just going to keep migrating to wherever the land was the cheapest.
That
process is still very much with us.
Well, I'm not even going to get into the monument thing. We need to take a really quick break, and we'll be right back with our guest, William Kay. You're listening to We the People Radio. Thank you to our sponsor, Powerhouse Solar. And they're not just doing it to be fly-by-night solar guys. They're actually doing it to help you lower your power cost if you'd like to. We'll be right back. Sometimes they can't see the forest for the trees. That's actually a very telling song on every level for this particular program. So, William, next hour...
May need to let the music keep playing because we seem to have lost William, but I'll get him back right away.
Oh, we
hopefully.
Did?
Yes.
Oh, Gosh, we lost William. Now we're stuck with Linda Ronstadt. Bummer.
Well, isn't it interesting, though, that the European energy crisis or their inability to be
energy sufficient, self-sufficient.
Yeah, with fossil fuels is now our problem. And we have to be fair and deal with it and deal with them fairly because, you know, let's not use our resources or that won't be fair to Europe.
Right. Well, that's why we can't count Shasta Dam as a renewable power up here in Northern California.
Excuse the numbers.
Right, because they don't have a big dam in Southern California with hydropower. So we can't count that in our renewable portfolio. So we have to contrive all these other things.
Yeah, put up all the windmills up at Bernie and, you know.
Punish the guys in the north again.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just nuts.
He's back.
Yeah. Well, we were almost forced to continue playing a Linda Ronstadt song. That wasn't good. Hey, the book you were talking about,
Black Earth.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think we need to go into some of that next hour. You want to give people a sneak preview in case the news distracts them and they don't come back?
Sure. Do you want me to do that now?
Yeah.
Yeah, just a little preview and then we'll get into it.
I'm obligated to. If you notice on my website, on the right-hand column, there is now a list of 40 book condensations that I have done. And I feel obligated to condense any book that deals with the connection between German fascism and environmentalism. And that particular book, I had heard through the grapevine, talked about it. So I read it, but it was actually quite a treasure because it revealed a lot more than just the sort of the Nazi environmental connection. I knew nothing of this Professor Snyder until I read the book, and then I read a lot of his other writings and took a look at sort of the groups that he was involved with. He's very much involved in this high-level Viennese propaganda outlet called the Institute of Human Sciences, but the book itself was published simultaneously in 22 languages. It was thanks to the Bertelsmann Media Echo Chamber, it became a bestseller in 4 different European countries. It had a profound propaganda effect in Europe last year. And it gives a lot of insights into what the thinking is among Central European elites right now. This was a book about the Holocaust, but it spends more time talking about climate change than Auschwitz. And it reveals a lot about what these people are up to.
Well, that's where 98% of the climate scientists came from, was these books.
Well, that part of it is kind of creepy and crazy.
Mm-hmm.
How was it received, I guess, in North America?
Well, he's not very young. He had a previous book called Bloodlands, which was a similar topic. You know, he teaches at Yale sometimes, at Harvard sometimes. He's sort of a big shot over here, but he's really quite a celebrity over there. Mm-hmm. Very few people sort of read about it, that book here. Even though he's an American, he's a far bigger deal in Europe than he is here. The book was reviewed here. Some people sort of hit the nail on the head. It's sort of a hodgepodge of political views in the book. Reading over the acknowledgments, there were over 40 different academics involved in writing it. It was a really collective project. It's a real political thing. But here's someone, his own private writings, you know, extremely anti-Trump. I get the impression that he's a bit of a poseur. Like some of the things that he says would indicate that he really doesn't know his own field of expertise as well as he comes off. And this is a guy with a PhD in history from Oxford.
Interesting.
But he's not a big deal over here, but he's a huge deal over there.
Wow, that's kind of creepy. And the premise of the book is that, well, you give it. I'm attaching your review on the site for people if they want it, just so they don't have to remember all this stuff. But, you know, give them a little bit of it since you did like a 10-minute video and we have posted that, but...
Well, it's like I say, it's a bit of a hodgepodge. I'd say about a fifth of the book is taken up with personal anecdotal stories about how individual persons from Poland or Lithuania helped individual Jews escape persecution. He's trying to sweep a lot of stuff under the carpet. The reality was it wasn't just the Germans doing all the killing. There were a lot of groups from the Baltic states, particularly Lithuania and Poland, who were up to their elbows in the Jewish Holocaust. And he's sort of erasing that from history. And like as I mentioned, on 35 occasions, he does admit that there was this close connection between ecology and Hitler's thinking. Hitler was indubitably this raving environmentalist. It's surprising that someone like Schneider, who has got a PhD from Oxford in history and who specialized in this precise epoch of history, wouldn't know anything about that until 2010.
That was interesting.
Yeah, and believe me, at that point, I mean, there's books published by, you know, Yale and Cambridge, you know, exclusively focused on this topic. I've condensed every one of those books on the website. And some of these books came out in, you know, the 80s and 90s, you know, biographical accounts of some of the leading ecologists in the Third Reich. So it's just inexcusable that Snyder would never have heard of this. But they give it the sort of weird spin. They make it as though that Hitler was the only ecologist on Europe, and that his ecology is what led him sort of astray. It turned him into this biological racist.
Right.
And all of the other fascist dictators in Europe, they weren't sort of infected by this weird social Darwinism, and hence they really weren't so bad.
And history's already been written, so we're going to come back with more of that. We're chatting with William Kay this morning. His website is ecofascism.com. You can find all of that on our site, wethepeopleradio.us. And thanks again to Powerhouse Solar. Welcome back to We the People Radio. Second hour here with our guest William Kay. I'm Aaron Ryan.
I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Bob Martin's where all the music comes from, just in case you're wondering why you don't hear him say much after that. He is. He says a lot.
He's a music man.
Do you get to do everybody's music, or do people pick their own?
Oh, it varies from show to show. But, some people like to pick their own. Some people like to let me pick it, and some shows are a combination
of
both.
Well, I just think you should tell them to just stop working on it.
Come on.
You're better at it than we are.
Yeah, hey, our sponsor this hour is Powerhouse Solar. If you're looking for solar, get a hold of Bruce and Sue over there.
For people who actually are going to be there.
Been there a long time, yeah. Their phone number is 275-6600.
That's their fax number.
Oh,
I knew you were going to say it. I was looking at it.
5600, excuse me.
I willed you
well,
to say it wrong.
Now they'll get a million faxes. They'll thank me for that.
No, everybody will call and get me. Be like, that guy on the radio is an idiot.
Oh, man, that guy. Time to cut that out.
What show was that anyway? Yeah. Never mind.
Yeah, never mind. Powerhouse Solar. Give them a call.
We treat all our sponsors like this, so feel free to get a hold of us if you'd like to join the crowd. You can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us.
You should give the number one more time.
Yeah, the real number.
275-5600.
Area code 530.
There you are.
Ta-da! All right. Back to William Kay and Hitler.
Yeah.
I've been dying to say that.
He's right beside me. I'll give him the phone.
They throw Hitler around all the time, you know, and it's always like, Hitler this, Hitler. Everybody's Hitler. You know, everybody you don't like is Hitler. Everybody who does something you don't like acts like Hitler. But it is pretty interesting that Hitler does figure into this this climate stuff. Kind of?
Well, the ideology, the Third Reich
was the greenest regime the world's ever seen. That is an established fact. They passed a law in 1935 called the Reich Nature Protection Law that unprecedented around the world. It required that every German landholder had to consult the local environmental sort of cliques before you could make any modification to your land. Within the first few years of the Third Reich, they created 800 parks. They they created the word organic foods was created by the Nazi environment minister, agricultural minister.
Really?
He was a real fanatic. He almost compelled the German government under Hitler to convert all German food to organic. I could give you like just countless examples of how the leaders of the Third Reich, Himmler, Goring, were just wilderness fanatics. Like Goring, you know, even when they were losing the war, he was just obsessed with sort of reintroducing old species into the German forest that had been previously extinct. They were animal rights nuts. Both Himmler and Goring switched to using human experiments, like doing scientific experiments on humans, because they thought that doing it to an animal was cruel.
God, doesn't that sound...
They were trying to bring back the oryx or something, weren't they?
That sounds like PETA.
Yeah.
Yeah, they really do sound like PETA. And yeah, you're right. He brought back quite a bit of this. You know, none of it ever sort of stuck. The reintroduction of these ancient species and that. But it just shows where their minds were at. These were forest fanatics, wilderness fanatics. They tried, you know, if you ever, what are they, I don't know what they call it these days. Back then they call it Darwin, sort of this sort of selective forestry or sort of, you know, really sort of minimal, you get rid of the clear cutting, there's none of that sort of stuff. Also, this sort of very selective eco-forestry, they impose those laws all over Germany, and they're disastrous, right? Talk to any lumberjack about just chopping one tree down amidst a bunch of other trees. You know, it almost kills every lumberjack that chops a tree down. It's a very dangerous way to do things, and it's a very non-economical way of doing things. But that was something that the Nazis imposed on German forestry. I could give you probably a dozen examples of green laws that were passed by the Third Reich that existed nowhere else in the world at the time.
Well, keep going. I'm kind
of
curious.
Many of which are still in effect today.
Yes. These sorts of laws were revived in the 1980s, you know, in the 1970s. You know, to some extent, that... You know, even now they don't stick. But the main thrust of it was, you know, what was called the Reich nature law. Keep in mind, there was a huge nature preservation movement in Germany dating back to the late 1800s. To understand it, it was very much an aristocratic dominated society. They did not want to see market relations applied to land. These were the, you know, they did not want to see free trade in agricultural goods. Even today, most farms in Germany are rented out. There are individual aristocrats in Germany today that own 200, 300 square miles of land.
Wow.
And this is all rented out, and some of it's urban, some of it's rural. But it's that clique that are still very much, driving the environmental movement were driving fascism before. There's a profound hostility to capitalism. I mean, here's an example. Think about, you know, California. What if they threw all the public lands of California open for development and more or less told the construction industry, sort of, you know, knock yourselves out, build whatever you want? There would be this sort of mass building spree going on. People wouldn't be paying $3,000 a month for a small apartment in Santa Monica. There would be the wealthy landed elites of the coastal regions would lose out. That was always the great dread in Europe, that if you really had a free market system in land, it would more or less make landlordism redundant. And they certainly didn't want to see free trade in agriculture, and they did not want to see a whole bunch of forest cleared for agricultural purposes. That would just increase the supply of agricultural goods. So there was a lot about capitalism that the aristocracy didn't like. And they certainly didn't like democracy. They were very accustomed to dominating political structures. America had a revolution in 1776. Europe never had that revolution. You know, even as late as 1914, like the eve of World War I, France was the only republic in all of Europe. Every other country was a monarchy, and many of these countries were absolute monarchies, where the king was, you know, appointing cabinet members, the king was, you know, arbitrarily and capriciously setting taxes and sentencing people to death and what have you. That was the norm across. This was the Europe of the czars and the Kaisers. Mm-hmm. They never had a revolution like America had. America was a revolutionary society, and the aristocracy hated it.
Yeah, I'm sure they did.
After World War I, there were these revolutions across Europe, but then there was this profound reaction to eliminate democracy. Germany had a revolution in November of 1918. The Tsar flees to Holland. The aristocracy are all still there. And then they begin a process of remobilizing themselves to retake power. And getting the Nazis back in power was this aristocratic restoration. One of the books I condense on my website, absolute gem, it's called The Reich and the Royals, and it's about the relationship between, the aristocracies and the monarchies and the European fascist movement. The author was an investigator with, Interpol and these international police agencies. They're still trying to hunt down all the stolen artwork. A third of all the artwork in France was stolen. That's just France is one example. During the fascist era, all the museums were cleaned out near the end of the war. The Germans were rounding up all stuff. They found a guy recently in Germany who had $1 billion worth of art in his basement.
Wow.
So there's still police forces around the world today looking for all this stolen art. The author of the book, The Reichs and the Royals, was one of those investigators. That book came out in 2005, Oxford publication. He was given an audience before the Queen and Prince Philip to help research the book. And he was also given access to a document that had never been made public before. It was in the possession of the United States Army. They had a complete list of the Nazi Party membership. And this was never made public before. And within that membership list, there was a list of all the princes of Germany that were Nazi Party members, and there were 270 of them. And 90 of them were members of the Nazi Party before the party came to power, but there were four or five other German fascist groups. Every German prince was an active fascist activist before the Nazis took power. Hitler had promised that he was going to restore the Kaiser to power. On the 2 years leading up before Hitler was granted power, the crown prince would tour with him and would speak on stage before him. People were coming to hear the crown prince. They weren't coming to hear Hitler. Another one of the Kaiser's sons had Nazi card membership number 12. Hitler's card membership was like close to 100.
Oh, no, you
really have to view.
He was an early joiner.
It was a real campaign by the aristocracy to retake power, to bring back the good old days, which weren't ancient times. I mean, Germany was an absolutist monarchy until the end of World War I. And the Nazis are re-secured in power in 1923. Everyone talks about, Mussolini's great march on Rome. And how they try to re-describe it as though it was some sort of revolution. Throughout the entire time that Mussolini was in power, the Kingdom of Italy was a kingdom. It was ruled over by the Savoy family. King Victor Emmanuel III appointed Mussolini to prime ministership before the March on Rome. This was done after the fact. And then 20 years later, King Victor has Mussolini arrested and deposed. Mussolini later said that the entire regime, the fascist regime in Italy, was a diarchy. That the king was actually exerting more power than Mussolini was. And that is a story that gets repeated right across Europe. In Europe today, there's still 9 monarchies. Some of these are the wealthiest people in the world. And where you don't have a monarchy, you have countries like Germany and Spain. Sorry, Spain is a monarchy. And Italy, where the aristocracy is still there. One of the books I condense on the website is called The Dukes, and it's about the British duchies. There's some 30-some duchies in Britain. The Duchy of Westminster owns a quarter of central London. By my estimate, he probably owns about 1,500 high-rise buildings in London.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
And that's a family that came over with William the Conqueror. But that's a pattern you see right across Europe. The Duke of Alba in Spain owns over 2,000 square miles of Spain. In Spain, colloquially, they're known as the 50. There's still 50 dukes and princes own probably 40% of all the land in Spain. That's a pattern you see right across Europe. And it was an effort by those people to reclaim power, to do away with democracy and free speech and things that they'd always hated. You can get speeches from these people who talk about how they have devoted their lives to suppressing democracy. They just fundamentally and emphatically believed that the masses did not have a right to participate in politics. They did not believe in free speech. They adamantly believed in censorship. They didn't think that all you're going to do is sort of stir up the mob. So sure. That sort of mentality was very present in Europe. And by 1940, keep in mind that Germany was not the only country that had a fascist dictatorship. By 1941, from the gates of Moscow to the White Cliffs of Dover, every European country is a fascist dictatorship. Germany was the ninth country to have a fascist dictatorship. The movement takes its name after Italy. That was the fascist party of Italy, but Austria, what is now Yugoslavia, what was then Yugoslavia, these were all fascist dictatorships before Germany was. It was a European-wide movement, and it was led by the monarchs and the aristocrats. And one of the key things about that book, The Reichs and the Royals, is that list of all those German princes who were, Nazi party activists, that was not made public until the year 2005.
No kidding. 2005? That's a long time to keep some of that, I guess.
Nobody thought to ask for it.
I guess.
They're very good at, the book itself sort of centers around this one family called the Hessens, and they were the princes of this small region of Europe, of Germany. And every member of the family, swastika on the armband, hardcore Nazis, they all survived World War II. One of them was Göring's right-hand man. And he concludes by describing what their life is like, the early 21st century. They never got one acre expropriated from them. They own hotels all over Frankfurt. They own vineyards. They own tennis courts and golf courses in Germany. They own farms. They own, all kinds of apartment complexes in Munich and places like that. They never lost a single, building or anything. They hung on to all of their assets. And that gets repeated over and over again in Europe. If you take a closer look at Europe, there's places like Monaco and Liechtenstein and Luxembourg and Andorra and San Marino and Malta. There's all these absolutely medieval spots all over Europe where there isn't even the slightest pretense of democracy. And many of these people, the Prince of Liechtenstein, these are multi-billionaires. And almost every one of them has converted a little enclave into a little money laundering racket as well. But if you take an even closer look at Europe, all of those countries, even the ones that are sort of, broader sort of modern countries, they are, owned and operated. They're like a giant jigsaw puzzle piece of these little sort of princedoms and dukedoms. After the 1918 revolution in Germany, it became illegal to be officially a prince, although there was never any expropriation of their land and property. What the princes then did was just change their first name to Prince. So they're still there. Bavaria, which is one of the biggest provinces of Germany, still has a king.
The prince formerly known as Prince?
Yes. Not that prince who sort of blew his brains out on dope. Although these guys are famous for doing the same, believe me.
Oh, my gosh. We have to take a really quick break. Sorry, I blew
okay.
it.
Okay.
I got derailed with the princes formerly known as Prince. When we come back, we do have some people who want to know, what about letting all these hordes of refugees in? How's that factor
didn't
into
really
their
settle well with
yeah? How's
Germany.
That going to factor into their game and how they get away with it? You're listening to We the People. Join us online, WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies, you twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
Find that German battleship that's making such a fuss. We gotta sink the Bismarck, cause the world depends on us.
Hit the decks, a running boys, and spin those guns around.
When we find the Bismarck, we gotta cut her down.
The old classic Bismarck.
DJ Bob's giving me goosebumps.
Yeah.
We love our DJ
Bob. Supposed to goose step. Okay, you had a skill testing question.
Oh, my gosh. Well, so we have people in the chat room wanting to know what's the deal with
Germany and the immigrants they've let in.
How does that factor in?
Not settling well with them.
I've thought about this. I have 3 points on the top of my head.
Wow.
Point number one. I mentioned earlier that sort of, you know, the fascist mentality is really anti-democratic, and they really don't care what the general public thinks about government policy. As far as they're concerned, you know, they're not entitled to have a say. Immigration is a prime example of that. Should any sort of humble citizen of the United States or Germany say, well, I don't want to see all this immigration. Well, that's it, buddy. You know, the argument's over. I mean, the government has decided there's going to be a certain amount of immigration, and if you don't like it, then you're some sort of racist, you're some sort of bigot, you're some sort of throwback. But this is something that is not up for discussion. This isn't something that we could all sit around and talk about or, you know, discuss in a democratic society. Let's have how much immigration should we have in this country? Where should they come from? No. That is too delicate a topic to let the mob even think about or publicly talk about. So you see that, and anybody who complains about immigration, you know, outside the circle of polite company immediately. Second point, obviously elite groups, it's already pretty obvious, so you bring in a lot of unemployed people into a labor market, you're suppressing wages, supply and demand. That's pretty obvious, and it's obviously one of the motivations that goes on with these sorts of immigration policies. And it's one of the reasons why they really don't want, you know, the great unwashed mob having a say in this, because they're obviously not going to be too crazy about programs that suppress wages. What isn't talked about is, you know, a lot of these people end up on welfare. Certainly in Europe, that's what's happening. But welfare is the greatest gift to landlords there ever was. You know, the libertarians talk about, kick everybody off welfare. I'd love to see that happen, you know, because, you know, in any sort of modern industrial city, about a quarter of the population wouldn't be paying rent. In the real world, 80% of the money that goes off in any sort of social service, welfare budget, within the end of the month, that's in the hand of landlords and slumlords that own the business enterprises in the low-rent parts of town. So pouring a lot of immigrants into these ghettos, it's great news for the big landlords of Europe as well. Third point is about this, you know, the unholiest of alliances between the European aristocracy and the Arabian aristocracy. There you find another world where you have these absolute monarchies again. You know, not even the slightest pretense of democracy. And these are indubitably the richest men in the world, the king of Saudi Arabia and the sheikh of Abu Dhabi, you know, the emir of Kuwait. Nobody's got the money they have. I mean, nobody, you know, Bill Gates doesn't have the money these people have. And they are famous for bribery. And I think that a lot of the oil monarchies, and there's about, off the top of my head, I could probably name what have you, in the Arab world, they are having a lot of influence in European politics through the bribery, through the corruption. The king of Saudi Arabia has probably built 1,000 mosques around Europe. They really do have a sense of, you know, get as many Muslims over there, pour as many Arab-speaking people into Europe. It's all part of their little crusade. That is not just some sort of conspiratorial thing. It's pretty obvious. But at the very highest levels, you know, the European aristocracy and the neo-feudalist rulers of the Middle East, there's a common purpose there. You know, there's a mutual animosity to just, you know, normal sort of conventional democracy, human rights, free speech, things like that. They all agree that they don't agree on that. So I think there is an alliance between the European aristocracy and the Arabian elites to further this project. And there are people who in Europe, who, you know, like wealthy landlords and certain employers who are, you know, materially benefiting from this wave of immigrants. And you know, the bottom line is that the public is completely disenfranchised. You're not allowed to complain about this. I mean, you people live in California. You've seen this whole thing. There's been, you know, probably excessive immigration there, and it is just foreboding to complain about it, unless you really want to get branded as being a very bad person.
Yeah, right.
But won't they ultimately lose their grip of power as the population sort of shifts over to the foreigners? I mean, won't they lose their power base?
They're probably not thinking that long term. Keep in mind the protagonists here are to a large extent the oil monarchs. Their power will expand. The European elites, I think there's a lot of American politicians who are in the pockets. You know, these guys, they all wear these robes. I mean, if they have pockets. But they're instruments, they're tools of these Arabian elites. This is, I don't know, did you guys catch that article? Here's the story. In June of last year, one of the senior princes of Saudi Arabia gave an interview to a Jordanian newspaper. This is one of the mainstream newspapers in Jordan. And he was wrapping off, and he said that his family was personally bankrolling 20% of Hillary Clinton's campaign. She spent $1.2 million. That comes to $2 billion. That comes to $240 million that the Saudis gave the Clinton campaign. It was when people started reading it, people outside of the Arab world started reading it, there was a lot of panic. It got pulled off the website. The Jordanian government later said that they thought that must have been the result of some sort of hack. But you can get cash copies of that article. That kind of money is definitely flowing into Europe. And they're influencing a lot of politicians. So, yeah, they're basically engaged in treason. I hear what you're saying. Down the road, you're going to end up with this huge Muslim population.
Yeah, sure.
It's going to be completely unruly.
And it's going to start at the lower levels and work its way all the way up.
And their goal is to take over those societies, impose their own form of rule, you know, Islam.
Sure.
And subjugate everybody else. They're pretty straightforward about it.
But keep in mind, a lot of these European aristocrats, you know, they never believed in women's rights. They never believed in democratic rights.
Oh, that's true, too.
They believed in sort of just these, you know, just wrenching dictatorships. There's an excellent book. I reviewed it in one of the previous ones called Political Repression in 19th Century Europe. And it's just about what an absolute hellhole Europe was from, you know, 1800 to World War One. I mean, if you tried to organize a public rally to advocate for democracy rights or for, you know, for voting for the adult population in Berlin, you know, cavalry would charge at you. And then later in the evening, detectives would go through the hospitals looking for anybody with a saber wound and arrest them. I mean, that was Berlin in the 1870s. The old guard in Europe, the old aristocratic old guard, is absolutely opposed to democracy. So it isn't as though they have got some sort of, you know, real political, moral complaint with life in the Arab monarchies. You know, it all comes down to ultimately freedom of speech and freedom of assembly and you know, no taxation without representation. I mean, the sort of basic, what we call human rights over here, they don't exist over there, and they never existed in the good old days of 19th century Europe.
Right. So I guess it really wouldn't matter because they've survived. Their power has survived for decades, whether it's a monarchy or not. So I see.
Taking an example, you know, Prince Albert of Monaco. Now, he's the head of state of Monaco. It's not a big place. You know, 40, 50,000 people live there. He owns about a third of all the buildings in Monaco. He's a part owner of the Monte Carlo Casino. He owns banks, you know, for people to launder money through there. Plus, he's used those profits to buy up real estate all around Monaco, all over France and places like that. He's a multi-billionaire. He's a raving environmentalist. But when he is in Monaco, he's God Almighty. And you know, you think, well, what's that doing in the 21st century? Well, you take a really good closer look at Western Europe, you'll find that all over the place.
Wow.
You know, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg, you know, Sweden is a kingdom, Norway is a kingdom, Britain is a kingdom, Spain, Netherlands. These are not monarchies. These are kingdoms. And it's not like the House of Orange-Nassau, the royal family of the Netherlands. There's no possible way to put a number on how wealthy that family is. They are multi-billionaires. They call it Royal Dutch Shell for a reason. They certainly don't have controlling interest, but, you know, the general rule of thumb is they probably own between 5 and 10% of that company, and that's the most profitable company in the history of capitalism. So all across Europe, you know, if you really take, just twist the microscope one more time, you see just how far from being a democracy it is.
So as far as the green movement goes, they can't lose, really.
They can impose it, and the fact that our guys seem unable to get the ball through the goalposts is probably absolutely frustrating to them. And I'm sure the advent of Donald Trump and the elimination of global warming from the White House webpage is probably causing hand-wringing over the weekend.
Yeah, it's not going over real well.
We need to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, okay. William Kay. You are listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. That was the theme song of the White House website change.
Okay, go back.
Goodbye, global warming. Because here in California, we're trapped with crazy Jerry Brown and his train to nowhere. God. Have you followed that at all, William?
Not very much. I know a bit about Brown. It's not something I focused on. Once condensed a book that dealt with quite a bit with, you know, the damage that had been done to rural and northern California by the suppression of the forestry industry and you know, the suppression of that sort of industry. It's tragic. We have the similar sort of problems here, you know. It's California in particular. I mean, it has so much public land sitting idle. If they ever wanted that place to boom, it's just a matter of flicking a switch and it would happen.
We're sitting on the largest oil reserves in the world, but we can't have them. We've got all this forest that we can't really harvest.
So we'd rather burn it down
every year and spend billions of dollars on fire suppression than then harvest it and replant it.
And then the Forest Service says they can't afford to keep the roads open in the forest. Well, if they
sold some timber,
could actually do that. And you know,
it's tragic. It's very similar to British Columbia, which is sort of off the coast from there. There's a moratorium on looking for oil off the coast of British Columbia. It's also a place that's well known to have, you know, billions of barrels of oil and even more natural gas there. But now they've prohibited any company from even doing any further seismic testing or any other sort of geological investigation. That's against the law. I mean, we know it's there, but don't even look any closer. British Columbia has a moratorium on uranium mining, although it's well understood that there are vast deposits there. It's a place that, you know, it's in similar boat to the whole Pacific coast.
Sure.
You know, it's operating at, you know, a very small percentage of what its potential is. There's one congresswoman, I do not have her name, from Washington State, who has proposed really throwing public lands open for development. That is something that Americans should really get behind.
The bad part is, I think the new Secretary of the Interior is a
Zink.
I mean, yeah, he's Zinke is against turning the land back. But he's one guy. I mean,
he's sort of sitting on the fence, and a lot of Trump's nominees, they sort of had to dial things back a bit to get through the hearings. Hopefully they will sort of turn it on again, but there's the opposition amongst the rhinos, you know, the Republican and name only types, that are forcing these guys to sort of really dilute their opinions. Hopefully once they get through that hoop, and they sit around a cabinet table and start discussing these issues like public lands, energy policy, climate science, they will be emboldened.
Yeah.
Well, I think if Trump holds his ground and kind of reminds them why he appointed them, I think it could change back.
Well, and you kind of have to remember, too, that those laws would be made at the congressional level and carried out by the cabinet.
Right.
So the cabinet isn't the one that, you know, makes the decision.
You're in for a real legal and legislative war. I mean, the question is, how much can Trump do without Congress? He wants to repeal a bunch of stuff.
The thing is, though,
the stuff that Obama was doing near the end of his term, they all do. They set up huge tracts of land under the Antiquities Act.
Right.
And they say that this cannot be overturned. I just don't see how that could be legal.
Well, the thing is, no one
can rewrite the Constitution.
Nobody has, like, monuments. We're talking specifically about the monument process. Monument ground is already public land. So, it's just a redesignation, but it screws up public land grazing, potentially hunting, fishing, mining, you know, anything that could take place on that land. It has a host of restrictions, but Congress has the
Grand Escalante coal reserve.
Yes,
they're in Utah, Colorado. You know, one of the richest coal deposits in the world.
And Clinton screwed that up. Yep. Well,
and that's just an outrage. And there's also near there. There's a in Canada. We have these oil sands, these bitumen oil deposits.
Right.
In that area, sort of Colorado, Utah, you got these things called the kerogen deposits. It's similar. It's like a really immature oil, but it can definitely be turned into fuel. And there's like a trillion barrels of oil there. And it got turned into, you know, public lands, public monuments. But there are some just mind-boggling fuel reserves in western United States that, you know, American citizens cannot get access to. And, you know, it's, Trump's got his head in the right place. But he's in for a war to really open that stuff up for development. You know, you open that up and you invite in, you know, foreign investors. And, wow, you'd have a massive economic boom.
Well, the big trick is that, you know, we have a couple of factors. If, in fact, he does things through executive order, not the rolling back of executive orders, but I mean new going forward executive orders, we'll see the same thing. If, in fact, someone else gets in there, it's easy to go backward on that. What you have to really do is enshrine it in law. Mm-hmm. Same, too, with the process of defunding. That'll be very popular, and that was done a lot during the George Bush administration when the House and the Senate were in Republican control. They defunded a lot of things. Problem is, when they do that, those laws are still on the books, and another administration can just add money to it, and poof, it's all back again. So I think everybody's really of the mindset, the Republican side is really of the mindset that, you know, we have to be systematic with this, and we need to roll these things back in a way that makes them harder to do again. And
well, it's to repeal a whole bunch of legislation. I mean, that Pruitt, he's been in the trenches fighting against environmentalists for a couple of decades now. He must know, you know, by name and number of the bits of legislation that have got to go. But you know, there's, like I say, there's elements within the Republican Party that are not on side. So,
well, they could start
the view from up north is there. That's the real battle.
Well, the House will be pretty easy because there's a big, wide cushion there. The difficulty is on the Senate side.
Yes.
You have 50 votes, and you need 60 in order to get beyond a filibuster of legislation or a hold. And if there's a filibuster or a hold, kind of dead in the water. But, you know, one wild card we haven't had in the past, I have a feeling a President Trump would have no problem calling out people who stood in the way of those things. That hasn't really been done a lot before. But I would imagine the pressure will be fairly great. And with, you know, Senate seats coming up for re-election in a few years, that's why, you know, the process of election is so great. You know, the people always have a way to kind of lean on them, and the bad stuff doesn't go on.
Sure.
You can hold
it up for 2 years, but in 2 years, there's going to be a whole bunch of folks up for re-election.
And so those people will think twice about, you know, jamming all of this because they have constituents. You know, if you look at the map of, you know, you look at the map of the country and how much of the counties, you know, you had 57 out of 3,100 counties in the country voted for Trump. I mean, those Democrats represent some of those.
I worry about, you know, like John
McCain.
He's always been a global warmer.
Yeah.
In addition to being this, you know, pathological Russia hater, he's to my mind, seems like a real menace.
Yeah, he is. And Lindsey Grahamnesty, and we keep hoping somebody will, you know, come and beat them, and we get disappointed again.
Yeah, they keep bringing home the bacon, though, so they get reelected. That's
frustrating.
What folks forget.
Well, the bad part is they're always featured on the media, too, like they're the spokespeople for the Republicans, and they're not. But the media likes to put them up there because their positions are frequently wrong. And it gets people all upset. And, of course, that's why we have news, is to get people all upset.
At least McCain is consistent. You know, if they want someone to, you know, rattle off his same line, he doesn't let them down. It was good to see that George Will got the boot. You know, the only, you know, American station that I can more or less tolerate is Fox. You know, I visit a lot of websites, but man, they need a changing of the guard at that facility.
Yeah.
They've got a lot of guys, I think, who are stuck in the pre-Trump era, and it's time to rotate them.
Oh, I think they're in the process of doing that.
They were all so wrong about this. I mean, everything about what they said, you know.
Well, they're still bucking a lot of it. They're still on the wrong side of this thing, and I just don't think they've learned.
You know the guy that's kind of fun? Do you ever watch Tucker Carlson?
Yes, he's one of my faves.
I really like that guy. He seems to have just sort of come out of the fog here after the election, I think because he speaks out, you know, and hasn't been a complete idiot and stuck his foot in his mouth, actually. That I'm sure that doesn't hurt him either. Megyn Kelly's gone, though, so that's kind of awesome. She's over it.
She wasn't exactly a good fit over there.
No, she's back.
Like I say, Fox, you know, well, the real story of the last election in America was the rise of social media. It was the rise of alternative media. It was radio stations like this. It was websites that people had an alternative. They didn't have to get everything funneled through, you know, five or six media conglomerates.
And I think a lot of that
is a real story.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that was brought on by the dishonesty of the mainstream media, and I think they're going to have a hard time getting the trust of the people back.
The bad
after
part
the
is
last few years people, of the shenanigans that they've been pulling.
Right, but people always say that they don't believe them. You know,
but
I mean, I get people who call me all the time, and they call me about something they saw in the news, and I always ask them, you know, do you think the mainstream media is telling you the truth? Well, no. But then they're mad about it anyway, right? I mean, I think we have not, as a society, been able to harness, to put a mental harness on our skepticism for media. We saw it on TV. There go, you know, therefore it's got to be ostensibly true. Even if they say they don't like it.
Back into the, the original topic, when I was investigating all the different ways these big European multinationals are affecting American media, I went down the list of the top television advertisers in the United States, and wow, you see a lot of like BMW and L'Oreal. It's one of the ways in which, you know, this whole sort of European thing is affecting American cultures. A lot of those companies are major purchasers of mainstream media television advertising, and a lot of their advertising are, there's a group in France called Publicis, and it's this mind-bogglingly huge marketing advertising company. And a lot of these companies go through them, so it's a very concerted and coordinated agenda. But nothing gets, you know, the mainstream media's attention like that. And a lot of those big European outfits are major purchasers of TV advertising time. And that's not going to change.
No, that won't change. I think people are going to have to just, you know, take a breath and wait and see. Some of this stuff is obviously pure hype just to keep people upset. I don't know, I guess maybe we're addicted to being upset. Maybe that's why these things still have validity along the way.
No, we're in the middle of the battle. And like I say, it was the social media, it was sort of alternative media sites, won the election for Trump. I'm not a huge fan of Breitbart. I do visit it regularly. But I think I can't remember the actual number, but in the months leading up to the election, they had like 16 million regular viewers.
Wow.
That was a blog 10 years ago.
Yeah,
and
no
now
kidding.
It's rivaling some of the mainstream media networks. And there's a lot of those websites out there that are doing that. And that's that the genie is out of the bottle. And we just have to keep pressing forward with that and doing really good research.
Yep.
And showing the sources of our research. And we will increasingly marginalize a lot of the mainstream media.
Yeah, keep track of what's...
In Canada now, almost all the newspapers are bankrupt. Same with the New York Times.
Yeah,
they're having a lot
there.
Of financial difficulties. They're slowly but surely becoming blogs. You know, they're descending down into the blogosphere.
Sure, sure, they've
and
stopped
so
reporting
good to see
news.
That happening.
We need to take one more quick break here before the top of the hour, and it will be the top of the hour. We've yet run out of time again with our guest, William Kay. And we wanted to know what you think will happen with the UN. So when we come back, maybe we can throw down on that one. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
There's an old piano and they play it hot behind the green door. Don't know what they're doing, but they laugh a lot behind the green door. Wish they'd let me in so I could find out what's behind the green door.
That'll be Europe's new theme song.
I think we know what's behind the green door.
I think we do too. Okay, so what about the UN? What's happening there? They're just a pain.
Well, it's going to be another arena of struggle. I mean, it's hard to believe that the United Nations was originally founded to advance the interests of the English-speaking world, but that it got co-opted fairly quickly, or about a few decades into its existence, and it has, you know, become one of the principal instruments whereby the English-speaking world has been victimized. Now, keep in mind that this whole Kyoto Protocol and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the United Nations Environment Program, this whole global warming campaign, the only countries that are really suffering from this are Canada, the United States, and Australia. Every other country is getting a pass, or they're a country like Western Europe that didn't have any fossil fuels, and this was part of their original agenda.
Well, because
the
we're the
global warming camp. Go ahead.
Those are the only nations that are actually abiding by the stupid rules that they're putting out.
Well, most of the countries got a pass, like India and China.
Sure.
From the get-go said, we're not going to, you know, actively suppress our economies. If you're suppressing energy, you're suppressing the whole economy.
Sure.
So they got a pass. The only real victims are Canada, the United States, and Australia. Three of them are vast countries with enormous natural resources regarding the energy resources. These are countries, if they allow them to bloom and blossom, would rapidly surpass Europe. And you would have a situation like you had in the latter part of the 19th century where millions of people would simply migrate out of Europe to Canada, to the United States. There's a lot of skilled tradespeople, entrepreneurs in Europe. If America was allowed to boom, if they really threw open public lands for development, millions of Europeans would again migrate across the Atlantic and put on roots here. And that's not a win-win situation because, you know, the sort of European landed interest would lose from that. So this whole thing was a campaign to sabotage primarily the North American economy.
Sure. Sure.
And the United Nations was the principal vehicle through which this campaign was launched.
Can you, you know, and every time you think about stuff like this, don't you, in the back of your mind, you have that, like, the scary narrative of, oh, my God, what if it was Hillary that was president?
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. See,
World War III and America, you know, it would be economically hobbled.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, there would be.
The crushing would have been
ghost town. Ghost town from L.A. to New York.
Yeah. William, we appreciate you coming on again. It's been
my pleasure.
Thanks again, a million.
Great conversation.
We are chatting next week with millennials from Berkeley about what's going on. The conservative.
I saw the ad. Looks like fun.
It is going to be fun. The Republicans at Berkeley are being crushed by their peers. So he's very chatty. I think we're going to like Peter Van Voorhis next week. Thanks a lot, William, we
My
really
pleasure.
Appreciate
Bye-bye.
It. Thanks to Powerhouse Solar for helping make the show possible. For information about sponsorship, show ideas, all that good stuff, go to wethepeopleradio.us.